All right, folks, this is another podcast this week. Really fun guest, someone that has a great show out that I think is really cool and unique. I'm going to talk to you about him in a minute, but before I get to that, let me tell you something. If you're going to talk to your girlfriend or your wife on the phone, in public, in a seat, in an airplane, on a tarmac behind me, can you just not do that? Or if you're going to do it with your hand like cupped over your mouth a little bit. Can you not have it on speakerphone, on FaceTime, and then be talking about what's wrong in your relationship loudly so everybody can hear you? And what is going on with people? This guy's just going on and on. He goes, you know, listen, I'm going to come home when I come home, but I got to sleep too. You know, I sleep. And then when I, you know, if it's going to continue like this, I'm not going to. And just for everybody to hear, everybody. And he wouldn't stop. And I'm sitting in front of him, and there's a guy sitting next to him. And it was just insensitive. It's like completely insensitive. Like, and this kind of, and then you hear the girlfriend talking, and then it's like his baby mama, I think, because he goes, you know, my girlfriend, you know, and that's my son. And you're the, he goes, daddy. And he goes, shut up, boy, shut up. And he's yelling at the kid. And it's like, I felt like I was in some bizarre reality show hosted by American Airlines. And you can't say anything because, you know, who knows who's got what on a plane anymore. You know, maybe the phone turns into a gun. I don't know. But Jesus Christ, keep your mouth shut and keep your personal shit to yourself. What's going on in this world? He was going on, and it's on FaceTime, and it was like personal. It's just, I wanted to turn around and say, you know what? You should have your kid taken away, and you shouldn't be in a relationship with anybody right now because you know how to interact with people on a normal, humane basis when you're just sitting in public with people. Then I land in Atlanta. You have to take a train. Guess who comes on the train? Mr. Hey, the whole world's going to know my shit. He's on the fucking train, going from one terminal to another, doing the same thing. Talking into the phone, FaceTiming. Yeah, I'm going to come. When I come home, I come home when I want to come home. And I do what I want to do. What is this? What are you, Jackie Gleason? What is this, the 50s? Who talks like that? And by the way, if you're an airline and you work for an airline, look, stop saying you're serving food on the plane. You make it meals will be served on the plane. And the woman comes around. And I upgraded myself to like a better seat, like a nicer seat that wasn't a seat for like a six-year-old boy that an adult could actually fit in. So I had to pay an extra $75. So I actually didn't lose feeling in my legs from the waist down because I was so jammed into the friggin' seat. And I'm an average-sized person. God forbid you're 6 pounds overweight. You have to put you can't even fit in the goddamn seats. So I pay extra for the seat. And they go, oh, and you get a meal with this. You know what the meal is? A wicker basket lined with a cloth napkin with little Quaker oat, like chewy granola bars and little bags of pretzels and those fruit gummy bears from Welch's. That's not a meal. That's not a meal. That's an intake of desperation. That's what that is. That is, you're stuck somewhere and there's a machine and you put money in the machine and you eat the shit that comes out of the machine. You do not walk around with a basket in your hand and tell me that that's a meal. That is not a meal, okay? You know what that is? That's not even an appetizer for a dorm room party, assholes. All right, listen, if you got anything that's bothering you, just tweet me, at Paul Mercurio, M-E-C-U-R-I-O, one R, not two. If you do two R's, it's going to bounce back, or it's a different guy, he's an Australian actor. So it's M-E-C-U-R-I-O, at Paul Mercurio. Tweet something you want me to talk about on the next podcast that's bothering you, okay? Just hit me up with a tweet, and I'll do it. There's so much stuff I'm trying to change in this world. It's exhausting. All right, my guest, Adam Conover. Host of Adam Ruins Everything on True TV. Really cool guy, funny comedian, smart as a whip, and created the show out of a character that he was doing for College Humor. It's a really cool story and a really cool show if you haven't seen it. He kind of debunks things that we think we know or things that are sort of myth You really should check it out. It's in a new season now, and hope you're going to enjoy the conversation as much as I did. Really funny, really smart, really intriguing guy. And please keep spreading the word about the podcast and give us some reviews on iTunes. And tweet me at Paul Mercurio, M-E-C-U-R-I-O, and let me know what's bothering you, and we'll talk about it on the next episode. Thanks, everybody.
I'll talk about whatever you want. Thanks. Does this cough button work? Does this thing work? I've never been in with a cough button before. I go, am I work? And you didn't hear it? You didn't hear it? Okay. This is great. This is great. This is a real radio studio. Yeah, I've never been in one of these before.
This is CBS.
The CBS Radio Network,
yeah,
or whatever.
Exactly. They used to shoot all the soap operas in this building.
Radio is really. Did they really?
Like in the day, I had Don Scardino, who's a director. He's a good friend of mine. He did 30 Rock and Two Broke Girls and Steve Carell movies he directs now, but he was an actor, like a young, I don't want to say child, like teenage, starting teenage as an actor, and he got on a sitcom, like Guiding Light or something like that, when he was 16 years old.
Wow.
He played like the young, hot stud, and he used to come to this building. He said we were cranking out like four different soap operas a day, 5 days a week in this building.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I love the history of these things. Like, it blew my mind when I realized that I was listening to like a really old radio broadcast, and they played the NBC chimes, like the dun dun dun.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, oh yeah, those date back to like the
30s. Yeah, I know. It's pretty crazy.
And
right?
And the same thing when I'm here, I'm like, oh yeah, CBS like
is
like the original network.
Down or no? I get you a different chair.
That's how high I am. I don't even touch
the ground. He said he can get a different chair through the cans.
Yeah, I love that old school stuff when they used to have the peacock like fan its feathers on the chime.
Oh yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of thing is like, I feel like unless you're in entertainment, most people don't care about like history of broadcasting. Like, who gives a shit at the end of the day? But
yeah, are we
I still
rolling?
Think it's cool.
Good. This will all be part of it if you don't mind.
Oh, I don't care. Whatever you like,
this
man.
There's especially living in New York, it feels like this is kind of where it all started. In
yeah.
A way, you know, so there's like, especially when you walk through like Rock Center, that
mm-hmm.
old school. We're talking with Adam Conover, the comedian host of Adam Ruins Everything on True TV.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Yeah, man, it's great to see you again. Your show airs Tuesdays at 10 p.m. on True. It's going into its second season.
Yep.
Great show. Nothing like it on TV, which is a big compliment.
Thank you. I would agree that there's nothing like it. Yeah. In a good way, I hope. But yeah, we do a really weird show.
Well, weird, interesting, and like organic to you and your interests, which is why I think it works, you know?
Thank you.
We were just talking about like old time TV because we just sit and we start talking on my show anyway, how we're in the CBS studios in New York City on 57th Street, and they used to shoot like all sorts of like when soap operas were like the thing.
Yeah.
They shot like four or five of these a day in this building, and it's got that sort of old school feel to it, which is really cool.
Yeah, I'm really into that stuff. Like, you know, now that I make a TV show, I've started to get a little more interested in like how other shows are made, you know, and mm-hmm. I realized that thing about like, once I realized with soap operas that like the classic soap opera, like they're on every day and it's a new show every day. It's like, wait a second. Like if you were to pitch that today, it's like, hey, every day we're going to do a new like hour drama and it's going to be a new script every day.
Right.
The executives would be like, what the hell are you talking
right.
about? How are you going to pull that off? And yeah. people have been doing that since like the 30s.
I know. They're so risk averse now. Like I actually had a small part on one we shot at Silver Cup Studio, which is a big studio in
Queens.
In Queens,
right? Yeah.
And, this was a few years ago, and it was like, I said to my agent, I'm like, well, I'm like a comic. I don't want to do it. She goes, you should just do it. They're fun to do, and you'll say you did it or whatever, and I did it. And it was pretty awesome because it was literally like I played Irv Wiener, the sleaze bag. I swear to God. Because I get mistaken for either Italian or Jewish. I'm Italian,
yeah.
but the Jews love me because they think I'm Jewish, so I just play along if I can get something out of it.
Yeah.
And they go... So you're just the sleazebag accountant. It was a small part.
I was about to ask if it was an accountant.
Yeah,
Irv
exactly,
Wiener.
Exactly. It was either that, or I was going to be. It had to be that, or a diamond dealer in Midtown Manhattan. And they dressed me in like a purple, in a suit, but then no tie, in a purple, big collared like shirt that was unbuttoned like down to my midsection, and it was like you walk in. You run through it once, you go to makeup and wardrobe, you come back and you shoot it.
Wow.
And all you're doing is going like, I don't want to fuck this up. I don't want to like ask any questions. And you're like, you want to do well. So like, do I ask questions or not ask questions? But you don't want to also, you know, get in the way of the process, you know, but it was really cool.
Do they expect you to be on top of your lines, or do people have like the sides in their back pockets and they're like, oh, I blew a take and let me just do it again?
It's a great question. I was off book and made sure I had my lines because I'm like a guest star, but like you could tell like who was there the longest because they were like, you know, half on the phone, still like flipping through their pages, shooting up, you know,
I was about to say that's exactly what I do on my show, with the exception of shooting up once you get that far. But yeah, I mean, I do so much text on the show, you know, on my show. It's like I'm, you know, I'm in every shot, and I'm usually saying per shot, because we do these long one take shots, about like two paragraphs of text.
Yeah.
And luckily I'm pretty good at, you know, reading something three times and then being able to recite it back. And so that's why I created the show I did, because it sort of plays to my strengths.
Do you have prompter?
Very occasionally. This year we did one.
So you're doing those long takes without prompter?
Yeah. And,
wow.
And so I'm, you know, I've got the sides in my back pocket, and usually I blow the first take, you know, because I don't, it's like still a rehearsal take, you know, but I just, you know, do it by, you know, I just learn it by doing it. I probably totally come off lazy doing this, you know, because I'm not, you know, maybe another actor's going like, why isn't he on top of his lines? Like, he fucked this take up for me, or whatever. I knew my lines. I'm just here doing one, and Adam can't learn his lines. He's the star of the show.
Exactly.
But it's because there's so many to do. So I just like, you know, like try to glance at it beforehand.
Well, as long as you have the essence of it, you know, right? Like, as if some of the words are off, I mean, it's
not on our show, man. Our show is fact checked, so we've got you know, a writing team and a research team. They fact checked all the scripts,
right?
And then I've got a writer on set, and occasionally I'll say, "Hey, I'm going to swap this word. I'm going to say, instead of basically a million, I'm going to say practically a million or something, or whatever, because I think it sounds better." And then, but the writer gets to veto because they know the fact check better than me, so they get to say, "Hey, man, sorry, the research department says you got to say it this way." And so sometimes I get to play around with it a little bit, you know, especially if it's like the character lines. But the fact lines, I basically have to do word for word. And if I say, because it'll be a lot of stuff like, "That's more than," or "That's almost as much as," or whatever.
Right.
And if you get that wrong, it's not true.
If it's anything that's a size issue, it's always, it's something in relation to the size of Rhode Island, which is where I grew up. So every fucking thing in the world is like a shit on Rhode Island. Like
that's
true. You know, when that iceberg thing broke off like a few weeks ago, like the shelf broke.
Yes, yeah.
If initially it was like twice the size of Rhode Island, and then it turned out to be twice the size of Delaware, and I was like, "Yes, suck it, Delaware!" Like, well, you now you know what it feels like.
It's funny because Rhode Island's the smallest big thing, so if you want to make something sound big, it's the easiest reach.
Yeah, exactly. So the process I'm fascinated by, which I wanted to talk to you about. You know, I worked on The Daily Show. We would sort of all have a newspaper in the morning that we were assigned. And then we'd have a producer come in with footage from all over the world, and we'd literally pitch stories to the head writer, like what we wanted to do that day, but much like an editorial, a staff meeting at a newspaper. And then we go like, okay, well, that one sounds good. We need four today. We'll do that. Well, let's see what we got for footage. And then we'd pick it, and then we'd go, and then we'd get some research given to us right away. And then we'd write like a maniac for 3 hours, like we're taking a final. And you can use the cough button for that. I know. That's why I have the cough button. He leaned over and I think either burped or something.
It was a small burp. There was no sound. Otherwise, I would have used the cough button. I was admiring before we started.
That's why we have the cough button.
The fancy cough button. This is like from an old time. There's a button in here that says cough on it when you press it. Let's try it. See, nobody heard that.
They probably heard it on my mic.
No, they didn't hear it at all. The cough button worked and they couldn't hear it. Nobody knew I coughed.
But now you're spitting up blood, so we can't do the interview.
Let me tell you, I'm fascinated by that process because the Daily Show, honestly, is when people say, you know, who's your greatest comedic influence? Like, Jon Stewart's like my Johnny Carson figure.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That's who, for me, that, you know, that show. And I watched the Craig Kilborn show. I love the Craig Kilborn show, too. When Stewart came on, I was like, who's this guy? Where'd Craig go? Like, I was literally, me and my whole family
really?
Were skeptical because we all loved the show.
Yeah.
And that was like right when I was leaving high school. And you know, so that show really taught me, hey, this is the pinnacle of what comedy can do, I think, you know, in terms of having an effect on the world. So I'm like fascinated by, like, oh my God, yeah, tell me what the Daily Show process was, you know, in whatever.
I mean, this is really going to be about you, but in one minute, it was really cool because, like, it was like kids in the basement experimenting and they let us go and we would do shit and then, like, we'd get in trouble and then the president of the network would yell at us like your dad yells at you. You know when your dad, like, mom yells at you but they're proud of you for doing the stupid thing that you did? Like, Monica Lewinsky, here's one that my writing partner and I did. We were all very passionate and still are, but we're not together now, like, it wasn't just a show for us. It was like a platform to say something.
Yeah.
So we would really kind of get mad, like in the meetings. We'd be like, this is fucking bullshit. You know what we should do? Like that kind of stuff,
yeah.
Right? So now we have that 3-hour window where you're writing from 10 to 1. You pick the jokes. The jokes get picked at 1. They go into production. For those of those listening, means graphics. Like, so let's say I have a joke that says pick a star, Liza Minnelli needs to have a hat, funny hat on her head. Someone's got to draw that in, or you need certain footage or a clip from a movie to help a joke work. And then we rehearse at 4:30, and then rewrite, and then shoot at 5:30 or 6. That was the day, but it was like just 100 miles an hour, and then you got to turn around and do the next day. Anyway, so Monica Lewinsky was rehabilitating her career. You know, she was like getting, I remember she had a handbag line and she did a Vanity Fair spread where she was a country girl and she had like this check shirt like knotted and she was like laying on a blanket like in the fields. And I was like, this fucking, what are you? I was so pissed. Like, not that Bill wasn't at fault, but like, you know, the kids, they got a young daughter. Like, you know, enough is enough, right?
Yeah.
So we go, this isn't the only thing she's doing. She also has endorsement deals now, which is good for her. You know, she's getting back on her feet because that was always our thing, was the false positive. And like this this product that's coming up, right, this ad's coming out right now for the milk industry. And it had, we had had him do a cum shot all over her face. It said, got milk at the bottom of it.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
So we're like, we literally were sitting like as about us, just like you and I are. So I'm at my computer and we're like, we should do milk. Yeah, we should do a cum shot on her face. And then we're like, yeah, you think they'll do it? We're like, I don't know, let's fucking put it in. So then we'd show, that's how cool it was. Like the head writer was like, oh, that's hilarious. And then they would conspire with you to make it happen by holding that. Well, for people listening, whenever you do a script for a network, it has to go to what they call standards and practices. The lawyers have to look at it, make sure there's no problems with it, and get signed off on by the powers that be, blah, blah, blah. We held the picture back saying, yeah, it's just a picture of Monica Lewinsky. We're just, you know, just kind of finding the picture. And then we aired it. And apparently, like, the president of the network saw it and, like, called. That show re-aired 3 times. The following day he called. It was like, don't re-air the show. Who authorized the picture with the cum shot? What are you, fucking crazy? And then he yelled at us on a Friday. And then we're like, he goes, don't do it again. And he's smiling. We're like, he wants us to do it again. But I think he wanted us to go over those lines and so that we weren't just another, like, you know,
you have
bullshit
to, you have to do that, you know. I mean, also, you know, on our show, like, you know, it's really important to, you know, I think fight for everything, especially for, you know, what the writers want to do. Because it's the same thing in our room, you know, like, just like the Daily Show, like, I'm the one saying all the words, right? But there's no way I can come up with all the ideas or all the arguments, right? And so a lot of times it's stuff that you know, the staff feels passionately about. And so that's stuff that, you know, we really fight for to get on the show. And it's totally that thing where it's like, you know, even if there's stuff where you're like, oh, man, someone's going to kill this.
Right.
We're going to push it all the way to the wall because then, hey, maybe we get the next one. You know what I mean?
You know, it's funny because I get the sense that you obviously you want to entertain with the show, but you do have a good agenda in that, like, sort of you want to sort of talk about things that you're passionate about, care about. And you've talked about sort of people who've written to you or talked to you about, like, well, why don't you take down religion? And you said, you know, I'm a non-believer myself, but then you said, I love religious music. I often find myself wanting to be in a religious state of mind, even though I don't intellectually believe it. I want to go to that place emotionally, so it doesn't feel like something that I really want to debunk.
Mm-hmm. And that's from I forget what interview that was, but I remember saying that.
And expand on that, because I was fascinated about the sort of the intellectual and emotional integrity of that.
Sure. Well, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, like will ask me, you know, people on Reddit or on Twitter or something like that, say, you should take down religion, you know, and I can sort of tell probably where I think they're coming from when they say that, which is their state of mind is probably the one that I did the same one I had when I was a little bit younger, where, yeah. You know, when I was a kid, my parents would take me to church, you know, and I'd be sitting in the pews going like, why the fuck should I believe any of this? Like, what's the argument for this? Like, reasoning through it myself and going like, there just isn't one, you know, like it's not.
And you can get jaded early. I grew up Catholic, and I remember being young, like 10, and coming through three times with the collection plate in one. Now, I grew up middle class. It was in a wealthy neighborhood, and I didn't have any money on me, so I felt so I just felt so bad that I didn't have any money that I faked it. And like, when the basket came by, I stuck my little index finger out more than the rest, and I kind of hit the change with my finger to make it sound like I threw change in there. And I was like, but that sort of made me do that in a way. So it was a skepticism that I had too.
Yeah, I mean, you see that thing, you're like, okay, these things are collecting money or whatever. Yeah. You see how, you know, religion throughout history has, you know, been very politically powerful, right? Often religion is more religious institutions at various historical points and to varying degrees and in varying countries have been more about, you know, amassing political power. And you know, if you read the history of the Catholic Church in Europe, it's like, you know, basically a kingdom unto itself, right? All that kind of thing. And those are stories that, like, hey, I'm sure interested in telling. And we've, you know, we've done stuff on like the history of Christmas and you know, et cetera. The history of how, you know, St. Nicholas became Santa Claus, that kind of thing. It's not like we would never do that stuff. But the idea of like doing a show about like, there is no God, let me prove it to you. I'm sort of like, you know, I'm in a different place now where I'm like, you know, what's the point of that, right? Because I think, I don't have a super strong opinion about this. This is just sort of, you know, that was me responding to a question in the moment. This is me responding to a question, you know, follow-up question in the moment. But, you know, when someone says, I believe in, you know, when someone believes in God or when they have a religious, you know, people's actually deeply held religious beliefs, you know, the ones that actually matter to them, you know, I don't think are based on like, hey, I thought through it and I'm pretty sure God exists because I read like an argument in a book or like I have some belief, right? There's an emotional truth to it to them that is divorced from, you know, intellectual knowledge, right?
And something that they just may need, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And whatever that thing is for that person, you know, for a lot of people, I would say for the majority of people who have those beliefs is like something that is very true and important to them and is like not something that I'm interested in disrupting or going after. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I totally know what you mean. When I read that and I was reading some other stuff about it, I likened it to, you know, I talk about political, social stuff in my act, but then there's the guy or the woman that like, no, I'm going to convert you to my view and there's something fucking wrong with you, like, if you look at it the other way. You know, and that was... That to me, I don't like to do. Like, you know, like I didn't vote for Trump. I would never vote for Trump. But I understand why some people did, and I'm not going to try. I'm entitled to my opinion and to comment on him and his administration and not like it. But I do think, like, up to a point, then you go like, you know what? But like, you do your thing and I do my thing, and sort of I'm just putting my thing out there. Which is sort of the larger thing in society of like, you know, it's become so divisive, right? So like, unless, you know, I go on a lot of these panel shows on CNN and MSNBC and whatever, and like nobody's really talking to each other. It's just, this is my opinion and this is my opinion, and I'm never going to listen to the other side of it. And I don't get that vibe from your show, which is good, you know, I think.
Yeah, I mean, we really avoid doing... I don't want to say we avoid doing divisive topics because that's not quite it, because we do divisive topics. You know, we've done episodes on immigration, we've done things in the prison system, etc.
That was a good, the prison one was great.
Thank you. I'm very proud of that one. You know, the experts we talked to in that episode are like incredible people who it was a privilege to meet, and you know, it was, it's a reality that people don't, you know, normally confront in their daily lives. You know, the thing about prison is it's invisible to us. That's sort of the whole point.
They don't even want to think about it. Like,
It's there so that we don't have to think about it and those people. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
it's
this is where we put people who we don't want to have to think about. And so it was, you know, and it's also like sort of one of the greatest horrors in America. And so that was, you know, the purpose of that. But, our goal is to, you know, avoid topics that there's just a couple topics in America where people are so divided on and so fractious about, you know, and so unable to talk about and unable to think clearly about, you know.
Well, you mentioned This American Life and how they tackle pedophilia and how that opened your mind.
Geez.
And I agree with you. Like, you need to be able to talk about everything.
Yeah.
But go ahead and continue. I know where you go. I think I know where you're going. But there's a really, I think it's a really powerful thing that you say about this.
Well, we try to what we try to do is do topics. I think pedophilia is difficult in a different way, and it's in many ways. the very politically divisive issues, you know, are so tough to talk about because people, as soon as you go in and say something about it, if you say, hey, let me tell you something you don't know about abortion.
Right.
Let me tell you something you don't know about guns.
Right.
No matter who, people on both sides are immediately going to think, I know exactly what I think. And if this guy, I'm now listening to see if this guy is going to agree with me or disagree
with
me.
That's exactly right.
And if he disagrees with me, I'm going to be right at him with
the
response.
That's exactly what I was saying about my experience on the panels.
Yeah, they don't have an open mind to any idea.
No.
So we try to do topics. I'd love to tackle those topics someday, but, you know, as I've only been doing this 3 years.
Yeah.
You know, as we, you know, like, as we get to those, we try to pick topics for the moment that people have a more open mind to, that they don't think about as much, you know?
So what, but why do you, I think you had said that, that when you've been established like This American Life, you've
right.
kind of earned, you have capital
yes.
with the listeners or the viewers, and you've earned the right then to, and the authority a la 60 Minutes as well, to tackle that tough subject. But now, you know, you're a very good show, you're credible, you're
Thank
really
you.
Smart, you're well-researched, it's well-written by any measure, like, I think you've kind of earned that spot. I mean, you know.
Well, I appreciate that.
You are the modern man's Andy Rooney, is what I'm saying. With
that's
fewer wrinkles.
My only,
and your balls haven't dropped yet.
That's
but,
my only goal, man. Man, I go back and watch that clip of him looking at the fruit once a year. You know that one?
know,
where he's exciting. Going through the fruit. He's like, what kind? We didn't used to have this fruit.
I know.
Go look up, guys, if you're listening at home, go look up Andy Rooney Fruit Stand if you've never seen this. It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's just his staff took him to a fruit stand and had to make fun of the fruit. It's great.
Exactly.
Andy, let's go down to the fruit stand with some cameras today and you'll just riff on the fruit.
Yeah, you get the feeling like the production meeting for his segment was he's on the phone. Andy, what do you want to talk about? Well, I took a shit this morning and... Man, I never took a shit like that. I think I'm going to talk about this. Okay, sounds good. We'll see you in the studio.
Well, so this American Life piece was about, this American Life piece I'm talking about was about, it was about pedophilia, and it was about how the topic is so taboo that we can't even address it. We can't even, right. like, address it in a reasonable way. And it's a real problem, right? A bad way to put it is like new pedophiles are born every day, right? This is a type of person that's always going to be around and that we need to deal with and that everyone wants to reduce the numbers of, right?
Right.
But the point the piece makes is that no one is researching the topic because it's such a taboo. No one even wants to make a grant proposal for it if you're a psychologist. No one wants to be in the business of, hey, I'm the pedophilia guy. That's who I
research. Yeah, there was a guy that wanted to get a group together of other pedophilias to kind of, as a way, like Alcoholics Anonymous, to kind of, to actually help each other to stop themselves from doing it, and he had to do it secretively. Like, he couldn't get anybody.
There was this kid who, this story is incredible. I mean, go listen to this episode. I guess Google This American Life Pedophilia, because I don't remember the exact title of it, but it's a full episode on it. And he has this kid who realizes that he's like, oh my God, I'm attracted to children. This is horrible.
Yeah.
Let me go talk to a psychologist. The psychologist kicks him out of the office and says, never come back here again. So he realizes he can't get professional help. And so he starts a secret online support group where everyone uses code names for him and a couple other people. Because, of course, there's, you know, literally cops running around the internet, like, you know, being secretively trying to bust people, you know? So this is like the guy who you're like, if anybody should be able to get help, this guy can. And he's basically having to do it secretly. Now, That now that story like nice cough button use, that was great.
Very smooth.
So that story like thunderstruck me, you know. But and I think they were able to do it not just because they had the credibility and people trusted them though, but it's really that 20 years of storytelling experience you know, that they have on that show.
That they knew how to tackle. So you feel like part of it is sort of you haven't quite earn the capital yet, but also sort of how do you pull that off? Maybe you don't think you kind of quite there yet to be able to pull that off?
I mean, that's a topic that like, you know, we heard that story and we talked about doing it in our, because a lot of times we will do our own version of a story we first heard on a podcast. We'll go back and we'll do our own research, you know, but it was brought to our attention through this means and then, you know, it's a historical story. So, or, you know, it'll become part of grist for our mill, you know? And we were like, man, this story is so good, but we just like in our writer's room, we did not feel ready to tackle it. We only did 16 episodes, 3 stories an episode. So when we're picking it, you know, there's a couple that we say, you know what, we really want to do something with this. Let's leave it on the shelf for next year because, right now, like we don't know how to do it right. You know, we also,
that's smart, man. I mean, that's just as important as going full bore into something as to It's funny, the pedophilia thing, still the ballsiest thing I've seen in a long time was Louis C.K. talking about it on SNL. Did you see that thing he did, that joke?
Oh, yeah.
You know what the ramifications are. You gotta really like pedophilia. And I'm like, oh, man, I can't. He pulled it off on live national TV. It was crazy. So are you, so your process is, how big is your writing staff? And I would imagine the researchers are incredibly important to this show. Yeah. I assume you start small, but then it goes well. They give you a bigger budget, and you can grow a little bit, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's so funny. The original web shorts we did were web shorts. You know,
were they for True TV or were they
those
pilot,
were for college,
college
humor.
Humor?
I was a writer at College Humor, and I did the first one. Just, you know, I had to write 2 sketches a week. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, we'd usually shoot one of them, and one of them was the original Adam Ruins Everything Diamond Engagement Ring thing.
You worked with Sam Reich, right?
Sam Reich, yeah.
Tell Sam I said hi.
I will,
because I did a couple of things with him over at College Humor, and he's a great guy.
Oh, he's the best. I mean, he's. He's look, I you know owe my career to him in many ways. Mm. You know, he hired me there, and
you started in 2012, right?
2012, yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And before, you know, I was just like doing stand up and
UCB, and also instructor. Yeah.
Yep. I mean, he's like, you know, the ultimate. You know, I mean, I'd say now I'd call him an executive, but he, you know, was formerly a, you know, sketch comedy guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And still has that, like, sensibility. Yeah, he has that sensibility.
Yeah, really good producer.
He's got the comedian's heart, you know what I mean? And so I, you know, I always really related to him, and you know, we always had a great relationship that way. And he was the guy who, you know, we made the first episode of, you know, Adam Ruins Everything. And just at the end, I said... you know, I did the original engagement ring short, and then I say at the end, well, join me next week on Adam Ruins Life's Greatest Pleasures, where I'll be talking about how puppies only pretend to love you so they can mooch off your food supply. And it was just a joke. It was like a fake series tease, you know, well, you hated this, so there's going to be more in the future. And I believe it was Sam whose idea was to... you know, make a couple more and then pitch them around LA as a series. And he might have been the one who came up with the title, who said, how about Adam Ruins Everything? It might have been Sam's idea.
Wow. I thought it might have been tied to, you talk about as a kid, like you were like sort of a kid that, you know, you were very curious, but also factually based and stuff, like kind of, I don't want, these aren't your words, but in a way, since like the kid that can ruin the party with like, oh, wait, but wait a minute, what about this?
I mean, the basic thing that the character does, right? And, you know, it's I play a character on the show. I liken it to how, you know, Larry David plays Larry David on Curb. You know, it's like a similar level of remove for me, I think. It's literally what I would do in my life, you know, where I would... I mean, I would, you know, have read something in an article and then people would be talking about the thing. I'd be like, oh, no, actually, you know, the thing about that is like a lot of people think this, but it's not true. And people would like roll their eyes and be like, OK, Adam, whatever, you know, et cetera. We were talking here. You know, that was like a real experience.
When you were,
And you know, honestly, so the original in the original short, I'm like interrupting Emily and Murph, you know, who are my two, you know, colleagues, other sketch writers of College Humor, to annoy them with this engagement ring information. And the reason I wrote them in was because I was self-conscious of, you know, at the table read, if it was just me saying all this stuff, I was self-conscious about the other writers rolling their eyes at me and saying, oh my God, Adam brought in this pedantic fucking script where he's like ranting about everything, you know what I mean? And like, isn't this a little bit excessive and like kind of a killjoy?
Yeah.
And so to get ahead of them criticizing me in that way, I wrote them into the script saying those same things, you know, like it was literally self-protective, you know? And that ended up being the comedic engine of the whole show, you know, of
them being the skeptic. The whole
There being a straight man who is, you know, always status switching with me, right? Mm. And that's what that's sort of what turns out to make the character tolerable, because it would be so insufferable if the character was just like, ah, don't you know that you know this, and then there was no one to ever go like, hey, you're an idiot, you know.
Sort of what Larry David needs in his show.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know.
Now, is that something you learned? I mean, you you were doing sketch in a group called Old English in college at Bard, right?
Yeah, yeah.
In 2002.
Yeah,
and
thank you for doing your research. That's wonderful.
And they and then is that something? I for those listening, UCB, great improv training, and part of what you do is sort of character development. Where did you sort of learn that knowledge that you had, like this character is going to be this unless we do this to the sketch?
You know, like that bit of knowledge I didn't pick up like from a specific class or anything like that. You know, you pick up little bits along the
way.
But
just your
gut
told you like, it's going to be insufferable to watch me for 22 minutes just sort of shit coming out of my mouth unless there's somebody else.
I think part of it was gut. Yeah, absolutely. Part of it was, you know, you just pick up little bits and pieces like, at UCB, you know, I was never good at improv, but I took, you know, the classes at one point in my comedy development, you know, and I taught sketch comedy there for many years. But improv itself, I don't take to that literal activity. I like stand up and sketch. But, you know, they have this idea of high status, low status. So, like, what's a high status character? What's a low status character? You know? And one thing that I learned from teaching those sketch classes.
Explain for people example of a high status, low status.
So, high status, you know, it's in a scene, like, the high status character, how would you describe it? It could be, like, class. You know, it could be, like, the rich, it could be rich man, poor man.
Right, so it's like the manager, and it's late at night, there's the manager and the janitor who's cleaning up, right?
Yeah.
So, you got high status, low status there.
But if the manager is being, you know, if the manager is, like, a privileged idiot, you know, is like the rich guy's son, doesn't know what he's doing, and the janitor is the crusty old hand who like subtly bosses him around, then the janitor is actually high status and the manager is low status, right? And so something I learned at UCB is that it's not funny to see a high status character shit on a low status character, right? But it's funny to see a low status character shit on a high status character.
Right.
And it's funny when you see it switch. Right.
Right.
It's funny to see, you know, the prince become the pauper, right? Etc. So that's one. So that's you know, those sort of like those are like really fundamental comedy dynamics, you know. And then the other thing I learned from you know, Eliza Skinner, do you know her?
Yeah.
Really funny comic who wrote on our first season. And taught me a lot. Really, really smart person. Really funny. And she told me, it just really stuck with me. I don't even know if it was about the show or not. I think it was. I think it actually was when we were working on the character of Adam. She said, you know what defines like a friendship, you know, as opposed to another relationship, like a relationship with a boss or a relationship with like, a student or something like that. In a friendship, you don't always have the same status relationship with the other person. You're not always above them or below them. You switch in that
Depends
same way.
Depends on circumstances.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, any friend, you know, sometimes you're the asshole. Sometimes they're the asshole. Sometimes, you know, my best friends in college, hey, I was late all the time. They were bad with money. You know what I mean? Or whatever. So sometimes it'd be like, hey, why are you late? Hey, why didn't you put in for the bill?
Right.
Or whatever. And so we realized that Adam needed to have the same relationship with the other characters and with the audience, you know.
Right.
So throughout the show, sometimes I'm like, you know, you can almost hear how my voice changes. Like I'll be like, you know, the truth about this is that you think it's this, but actually it's that, you know. And I'm a little bit sort of forthright, and then someone will say like, okay, could you stop? And I'll go, oh, sorry, you know. Like I'll do a little bit one of these, you know. And
you realize you're being kind of douchey.
Exactly.
Or whatever.
And so it'll be a quick.
So now the audience is sort of high status with you.
Exactly, and I'm low status to the character right. again.
So it's almost not this, but on Big Bang Theory, is it Leonard? Is it who's the lead character?
I don't know the names of the characters.
Well, you know the main nerd who plays.
I'm distracted by their outfits.
Yeah, exactly.
I can never learn their names.
Well, it's just like you see that, like it's like the guy who can't help himself and then has to be pulled back by others.
Yeah, the main guy. I mean, it's a very it ends up being sort of a classic comedy character. Like
Why did you feel it needed to be a character as opposed to just you delving into these things and sprinkling it with humor?
That's a really good question. I think, why wasn't it just Adam Conover, the person, doing a very similar show, but without the level of sort of fictional?
Yeah, I mean, and you know, you could have the title that implies the core theme of the show, which is sort of, you know, you're going to debunk things, everything the same, except that you're not sort of laying in some character traits. I'm just curious. I'm not saying it's better, be a better idea. Obviously, it's going great. But like, why did you feel it gives you more options? Maybe to.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think part of it is that we, in the very first web video, we had sort of established this little bit of a fake reality, you know, where Emily and Murph, who, by the way, are a real life married couple, but, mm-hmm. you know, when we made the first video, they were just dating.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like they're proposing to each other, you mm-hmm. know. And then I show up and they meet me for the first time and they're like, who are you? And I'm like, oh, I have a TV show. You know, I'm doing this show. That already had a little bit of unreality to it, you mm-hmm. know. So I think we sort of built it from there, like, okay, like the next time he sees Emily, what does she say? She's like, oh, you again, you know, and they sort of build a friend relationship. Mm-hmm. Whereas in real life, we're just like, you know, me and her are just buddies. But then the other part of it was like, I really, when we created the show, you know, before we created the show, I was just like a sketch writer on the internet. You know, I was mm-hmm. working at College Humor. You know, good, very good gig, but, you know, very sort of low mid-level comedy gig. You know what I mean? It's like, we're, you know, applying to work on TV shows and things.
How
like,
did you get that gig?
At College Humor?
Yeah.
Man, I was really lucky. I had worked a TV gig in LA for 3 months that I wasn't into. And I was like, I want to live back in New York for a couple months. You know, I was like, I don't want to move to LA yet. I want to go back to New York. And I emailed a friend I knew who worked at College Humor. And I was like, hey, are you guys hiring? Like, you know, the kind of thing that, you know, 99 times out of 100% says, oh, we're not hiring right now. You know, don't just email me and ask me for a job, man, you know. But in this case, this guy, Ben Joseph, really funny writer, I owe him I owe him my career, too. He'd always liked me, and he had, unbeknownst to me, been about to quit. And so he said to Sam Reich, he was like, hey, I'm quitting. You should hire Adam Conover, basically.
Wow.
And so, you know, and then, of course, I wrote a packet and did a job interview and everything, and they all liked me. But you know, sort of like got my foot in the door that way. And you know, that's like about as good a job. Like that to me was my dream job. I wanted to work there for as long as I could. I had wanted to work there for years and years. You know, it was like a salary job and benefits and stuff, writing 2 sketches a day. We basically got to write anything that we wanted, you know.
I did a couple of them with Sam. Sam was working with a group, and we had the same manager at the time.
Was it Dutch West? Was that his group?
I think it might have been. I can't remember now. But my manager kind of got me involved with them, and I thought they were really funny and creative.
Yeah.
We shot something down in Union Square and stuff, and
they let you do real comedy there. You know, like it's not, you know, it's not super, you know, chasing hits or whatever. It's like it really is like, what do we think is funny in the room?
Right.
You know, the kind of comedy writing that I wanted to be doing.
What didn't you like about your 3 month stint in LA? What was it? If you can talk about it, I don't want you to trash anybody or whatever.
No, I'm not. I'm not going to. It was you know, it was like for a, you know, sketch show that you know, didn't last very long and was like really rushed and like sort of put together under you know, some sort of, now that I've been in the business longer, I'm like, okay, I probably had some like weird constraints from the network and like budget issues and stuff like that. But it sort of felt like, you know, the comedy was secondary to everything else. And you know, also I'm just like a, you know, I live in LA now, but I'm still a New York guy, you know, like I couldn't drive at the time. So I was in LA, like biking and taking the subway around, which is really rough. So, But so when I created this show, you know, I was like, this is my one shot. And so I wanted to make it good in every possible way. You know, I was like, well, okay, we can do the information, we can do the comedy. But I was like, I threw the kitchen sink in the thing, you know. So I was like, I want to have there be a storyline too.
Well, it's funny because you say the ones I gravitate most towards, honestly, are the ones that have the strongest stories behind them, in addition to the information. So the thing that is sort of I liken to the Daily Show was that we really just wanted to talk about stuff that we cared about.
Yeah,
it had to meet some sort of general parameters. In other words, like, it couldn't be too local. You know, it had to just meet some practical parameters. It's a national show, so it had to be a national story. It couldn't be too obscure. But beyond that, it really, and that's where the best comedy comes from, is passion, right? So, yeah, like, I can see if you're sort of emotionally or intellectually divorced from the topic or the story behind it, and you're like, kind of, it's just going to come through on camera because it can't, you just can't fake that. You know?
Yeah. And when I really do, you know, I think when I'm doing my best performance on the show, it's when, you know, I really do care about the topic and I am able to, you know, put that investment, you know, into the way I'm delivering it. You know, it's like, you know, when you're doing stand up and you're telling a funny story, right?
Nothing better if it's personal.
Yeah, exactly. And if you make it funny, what you do is you go to that same place where the thing struck you as funny the first time,
right?
You said it or heard
exactly.
It 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Or you're mad again at the guy. What did this fucking guy do? Cut me off or whatever. And you're like pissed at him again and you feel it and it comes out of your body and exactly that same way it did.
Exactly.
It has, and you do that over and over again, two times a night, right? And so, if it feels that genuine, that's how you're able to do that, right? And so, yeah, if I'm able to go on and I'm talking, you know, and I need to really twist that knife about, like, you know, let me tell you about how serious this topic is. If it's something that, like, I really give a shit about, like, the, you know, if it's about the prison system, it's not hard for me to get that fire behind it because I really feel that way about it.
What is your production week like? So walk me through sort of how a story, the germination of a story, how it originates, makes it to air, and all of that.
Sure. Well, our let's see. I mean, our show has a pretty long production cycle. I mean, we do a ton of episodes. This year we'll have done 16 episodes in 10 months. Which is nothing compared to the Daily Show, obviously, but, you know,
that's a lot. Trust me, 16 and 10 months is a lot.
Yeah. For a show that's produced the way ours is, you know, so we have, we have sort of open pitch, right? Anybody can pitch. We have
researchers, writers. How big is your writing staff now?
This year, I was going to answer this question like 15 minutes ago. This year it was 7 writers, 5 researchers, plus, like, you know, me and a couple other producers. Our first year it was 3 writers and 1 researcher, and we did 11 episodes. So
we had 6 writers and one researcher and
that's
a couple of producers
for the Daily Show
in the beginning.
6?
When Kilborn was there.
Holy
crap! And looking back, it was like
Yeah,
it was more written word then because we didn't have the budget to get a lot of footage. Like, we were literally like steal footage from like CNN, and then they call and threaten to sue us or whatever, and then we'd go steal it from somebody else, and we're finally like, we need some money to like.
I think a lot of shows work this way, where at first it's like you don't have enough money to actually do the thing, and then the reason it comes out good is because everyone just guts it out, you know, and spends.
You find creative ways to make it happen.
Yeah, and everyone just spends all day at the office and whatever, and burns themselves out.
But three,
and then,
like, 3, right? That's crazy.
It was crazy to do 11 episodes. It was nuts, everybody pitches.
Hey, there's a cough button.
Okay, let me try again.
I can't work. This guy's so unprofessional.
Dang it, my God. I'm getting over a little cold.
Yeah, so
everybody pitches.
Pitches are fun, too.
It's great.
You got to cut those meetings short because you could go on and on like you start bullshitting,
pitch meetings are so much fun. That's when you're really like, oh, we're really doing it. And then the rest of it, you're like, my God, it's a slog. But when you're pitching, you're like, we're making a TV show. Day one is the most fun day.
Yeah.
You know, we do that. Our research team goes back and the pitches come from, you know, we've hired really, you know, we hire smart folks who you know, are like me, are like sort of information sponges, you know, and have like read and heard things, listened to podcasts, stuff like that. And so it's just like, hey, what'd you hear recently that blew your mind? Like, what's something that you know about that nobody else knows?
Yeah.
What's, you know, et cetera.
Yeah. It's funny. That's how Ray Romano would pitch his show every week.
Really?
They come in on Monday and it. you go around the room, everybody on staff would be like, so anybody got any interesting or weird stories that happened over the weekend? And a lot of times serious episodes would come out of that.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, you know, I was at the market and my brother and blah, 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 and this happened and there was an accident in the parking lot. And I was like, okay. And that, it's so very similar.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the best place to get, I mean, you know. That's,
so you got people pitching who are smart and passionate, kind of information junkies.
Then we go run it down, you know, the research team goes and runs it down, make sure there's something to it. The best stories are the ones where if there's been a really good piece of reporting that's already been done that we can rely on, so something from like the New Yorker or ProPublica or the Atlantic or like a big nonfiction book that came out, something like that, you know, that we can really base stuff on, you know. then we go back and whatever that piece is, we go into its sources, we do a little bit more digging, so we're not just copying the work, you know, we're like doing our own synthetic research as well.
And that includes, you have to have some experts, right?
Yep.
So and have there been stories that you've had to kill because you just couldn't run down enough foundation for it or experts?
Yeah. I mean, there's stuff that's fallen apart, you know, because we go pretty deep into it and then we find out, oh, wait, this is like actually kind of a fringe opinion, you know, this is not... Well, you know, this is like, okay, this is how this one expert looks at it, but, you know, 8 out of 10 of that person's colleagues is going to say, hey, this is not the whole truth or, you know, et cetera, or we have to make big revisions, you know. So, and that's tough, you know, like we often find ourselves scrambling or we have trouble getting, you know, getting an expert. I mean, we have one episode that we just shot. It's not airing for a couple months, but it's about the economy generally. And, you know, we want to tell, hey, here's the real story of why, you know, America doesn't have the manufacturing economy it used to. Mm. You know, it's not greedy bankers sent the jobs overseas, right? There's all these other forces at work. And so we wrote this segment. We talked to like 3 or 4 different economists and they all said, hey, this all looks great. This all checks out. You guys are right on the facts. We would all agree with this. I'm not going to come on TV and talk about it. And we're like, why? And it turns out economists just don't like making pronouncements on television that much because it's a little risky for them, you know.
Yeah.
They don't want to go on.
There's no wiggle room. Once it's on tape, it's on tape. Yeah, and you can't take it back.
Exactly. And so they're conservative, lower C conservative about not wanting to go out on a limb, you know. And so we had a couple people who we based the work on the episode on their research, and they said, "Yep, you represented my research accurately, and I think that all makes sense. I don't want to come on TV and talk about it." And so it took us a couple steps to find an economist. We found a fantastic one eventually, but you know, it was a little bit down to the wire. Like, "Ooh, we're taping this soon. Like, we gotta get someone on the air." You know, that happens. But then more often though, we get these incredible people who, you know, we say, hey, we love your work. We want to, you know, put it on TV. Would you come talk to us about it? And they are like, oh my God. Yes.
Finally, someone that's going to give me a voice. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, they are really the heroes of our show because, you know, to me, it's like the best part of the show is that I get to meet these people.
Yeah.
'Cause, you know, I'm a failed academic. I wanted to go to grad school, you know.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
You didn't want to, I mean, you know, you're talking about being passionate about like the Daily Show when you were in high school, whatever. This the path, not the show, but sort of entertainment was your path then, or were you thinking?
You know, when I went to college, I didn't believe that I could, go into comedy. You know, it didn't seem like a real possibility. You know, I think a lot of people say, "Oh yeah, I didn't even think of it as being real for a long time." And I went to
I had all of a career and I quit to do this. So.
Oh yeah, you were a lawyer.
Yeah.
I went to Bard College and I fell in love with, like, you know, I was a philosophy major, fell in love with philosophy and like the academic lifestyle, you know, like pondering the big questions and everything. And I loved how sort of like real, you know, how honestly it was about getting at the real truth of the world, you know. And I wanted to go to grad school and all of my professors and my parents are just sort of like, you sure? Like, none of them were like, go for it. You
really?
Got it. Yeah.
Why? Because it wasn't a lucrative profession, or because they didn't see you having the chops for it?
I think it was a little bit of both, you know. And I think I think part of it, me having the chops, I think part of it was a little bit like unfair, low expectations, perhaps. I think part of it was was real, because, you know, I was a real, I was like a true ADD kid, you know what I mean? And I had trouble getting the, I loved the ideas. I had trouble getting the reading done. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you got to read these dense things. And I would get the ideas and I would love talking about the ideas, but like, you know, I would have trouble getting through it, you know?
Yeah.
And so when I, you know, at college is when my college sketch group called Old English started, like, you know, we got a little bit of heat on the early internet, you know, early video internet. And I started to realize, oh, wait, comedy is a way I can sort of talk about these ideas in a different way. I had a little bit of an inkling. I was like, well, I love ideas. I love working with ideas. I love learning things. I love talking about these things. And maybe I can do that through comedy, you know. And it took about 10 years, like more than 10 years.
That's not a long time.
Show.
I mean, that's also very mature at a young age to kind of already know where you think your voice is. You know what I mean? Take some people forever. Some people don't ever hit it. But to know at 20 or 19 or whatever in the middle of college, what were you doing that went viral? What kind of stuff were you doing that kind of?
Oh, man. I mean, it was so early on the internet. Like, you know, we started posting stuff in like 2003, you know?
Wow.
And so that was a couple years before YouTube.
Mm.
And so we would encode the video. You know, I was just always good with computers. So I was the guy who did our video editing, because I'm the kind of person, you give me a new app, right? And I can learn how to use it just by, okay, how do you, let me look at the menus,
yeah.
You know? So I learned how to use Final Cut Pro. I owe so much of my career to Steve Jobs, because, I'm serious, because when I got to college, they had just invented these, you know, they had DV camcorders, you know, like the little tapes, digital video.
Right.
And Apple had done this thing where it's like, okay, we're going to make it really easy to ingest the video onto Macs and edit it, and created Final Cut Pro. And our computer lab at college had like a ton of Macs, you know. And so we taught ourselves, none of us were in the film program.
Mm-hmm.
We just taught ourselves, hey, here's how we're going to shoot and edit our own sketches. And so I was the guy who learned video editing because I was good with computers. And so we would compress the video to QuickTime. You know, I did it myself. I learned how to make web downloadable videos, and I also knew how to make websites, so we threw them on the web. And there was no YouTube yet, so our videos were some of the only video comedy on the internet. So we got like a lot of pop just for that reason alone. You know, and then we did a couple clever things.
Yeah.
You know, like I directed a video where it was called Gym Class, and it was where all these kids start doing like a shootout in a college or high school. Man, this is really sounds like a school shooting thing. It wasn't. In retrospect,
We did a mass shooting sketch, and it was hilarious.
Well, they do it with they basically do an action movie, but with finger guns, right? They just point their fingers.
Well, it's sort
at
of like
other.
Laser Kitty, right? Was that thing where SNL,
Laser Cats?
Laser Cats with the laser.
That
eyes?
Was that was very sci-fi with cats.
Yeah,
this was like a this was not sci-fi. It was more like we were doing a Guy Ritchie movie, everyone was just using their and so one guy like does a mimed sniper rifle, you know, etc. Like we did a lot of like of those tropes. And so that one did really well. And then after that, we moved to New York, and you know, after we graduated college, we moved to New York and started doing comedy there. And we were sort of part of this early web video boom, where for like a year, internet sketch comedy groups were like hot. And so we went to Aspen Comedy Festival and stuff like that. When I was like, you know, like 22 or 23 or something like that, we went to the Aspen Comedy Festival, and then the group broke up and our careers totally dried up, and I had to start from zero because that little like hot moment ended and we had nothing else going on. And I count myself as so lucky for having had that experience, because, you know, I was like, hold on a second. I just 2 years ago I was at Aspen, and now I don't have a comedy group. You know, we were young, so we were like assholes to each other, and so we like couldn't stand each other anymore.
Yeah,
and we're
all right,
we're taking those guys are still my best friends, but you know, we stopped working together quite so closely. And I was like, we're not performing anymore. What do I do? And I just started. You know, I was like, okay, I don't want to in 5 years have quit. You know, so I started taking improv classes. I started teaching sketch at UCB, and I started doing open mics.
Yeah.
And I ended up didn't take to improv. I took to stand up real hard. You know, I was like, oh, I love this. And having that experience of having early success and then having it all disappear, you know, and having to start again from zero, I'm so happy to have had that experience.
Why?
Early, because I know guys who start. You know, started the same time as me, but have their first success at age, you know, 34, like I am now. And I think you're a little bit worse off if you haven't had the experience of the up and the down, right? Because I know people who, you know, think, okay, well, now that it's going to go forever,
you
know, and then whenever there's a little bump in the road, right, where like they don't get the opportunity that they thought they were next for or whatever, they sort of panic because they're like, wait a second, I thought everything was going to go good forever.
Right.
You know, like,
right,
oh no, it's going to crash and burn, you know. But since I had the experience of like, hey, I had a, it went hot, then it went cold, and then I build it back up again, I'm not scared of if
it happens again, you feel like you can figure something out and there'll be a lull, but there's an upside. It'll come. Yeah.
If my show were canceled tomorrow, mm-hmm. I know what I would do the next day.
Hang on.
You know?
Your show's been canceled.
Fine. I'm hitting the open mics. I'm hitting the open mics tomorrow, you know? Like, I'm happy to do that,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like,
that's a great perspective because that's what you have to have in this. Like,
yeah.
Look at John Travolta, top of the world, then... You know, nothing. And then, I mean that seriously. And then he comes back with the thanks of Quentin Tarantino. Like, they're massive, massive people who, like, go away and then, you know, they come back, get reinvented or whatever. It's like, it's,
And that stuff, you know, you can't control that stuff. It's going to go up and down.
Yeah.
You know, and all you can sort of control is how you react to, like, the challenge of the day, you know. So I'm happy to have had that experience.
Yeah, no, it's great.
Know?
One last thing. Do you... We found, like, sort of, you know, once you the idea of producing a show, even though you were doing it on a small level with these video sketches and segments, but like once you get into the production of an actual TV show, how different was it than what you thought it was going to be, or was it not that different because you had already had some sort of, you know, experience in producing and directing and everything else?
That's a really good question. I had been on sets and, you know, working at College Humor was like a really good, preparation for working on the show, because as a writer at College Humor, you're really like the main producer on the whole thing, you know, so you give notes on the edit, you know, and your notes go, you know, so you're really sort of like, you know, above the director and the editor and everybody else if you're the writer. So, a lot of it was just, an extension of that. In terms of like what was...
Maybe for us it was sort of like it's a long day. It's a lot of days back to back.
Oh,
it's sort of the exhaustion of sort of just... It's like it's a marathon that you're sprinting the whole time. I don't know if that's the case. But 16 episodes times three, that's a lot of stories to break.
No, that is a marathon length sprint is exactly what it's been for us. And you know, the challenge for me has always been to try to, you know, reduce my own, you know, degree to which I'm sprinting while still doing the same amount of output, you know, because like I always... You know, have done everything I've done in my career as like, hey, I'm just going to gut it out. I'm going to put in the most work, you know, because when you don't have money, right, the thing that you have that I've always had, you know, in stand up or, you know, in sketch when I was working in that group or anything is you have your own time, right? That's the resource I have to pour in. So I will always pour in as much of my time as possible. But, you know, so that first year when you had three writers and one researcher, I worked 18 hours a day on the show. Now I think I've gotten it down to 17 hours a day. You know what I mean? And so I'm working to that's the main thing I'm trying to I'm trying to do. And I'm learning more how to, you know, the skill of building a staff that, you know, I really trust.
Yeah, you know.
And
that's
that,
important.
And we have a network of trusted sort of high level staffers who, you know, I can say, hey, you know what, these guys will figure it out.
Yeah.
And I don't need to exactly approve what this gag is, you know what? I asked those guys to figure it out, and the three of them said, hey, Adam,
you
have a solution. And I'm going
to
show up on the day, and I'm going to like it or not, but, you know, 9 times out of 10, they'll get it right.
Yeah. You have to trust, otherwise it doesn't work. You can't do everything. But this has been great, man. I'm really happy for you. The show's fantastic.
Thank you.
You know Adam from the sketch comedy group Old English? No.
Some people do know me from that, and it always makes me happy. People, hey, I loved your sketch group. Like, that always makes me really happy.
That's awesome. Tuesday nights, True TV, it's 10 p.m. and you're in the middle of finishing up this season, right? You got a few more episodes. You said
we're shooting two more starting the next 2 weeks, and then we're finally done for the year. Yeah.
All right, cool, man. It's great to have you on, and we got to do this again and just shoot the shit about other stuff. But congratulations. Say hi to Sam for me.
I will.
Yeah,
I will.
If nothing happened today, you learned how to use a cough button. See you guys. All right.
Hey, man, that was wonderful. That was one of the best ones I've ever done. Thank you so much,
man. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, that was Adam Conover. Very cool guy. I think you could tell. And I think his show is really fantastic. It's very unique. There's nothing like it on TV right now. So check that out and tune in next week for another cool guest we got coming up. I pre-recorded him this past week. You're going to really enjoy it. All right. See you next week, everybody.
A Westwood One podcast production.